Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. As U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson prepares to meet with China's president, he told reporters Saturday the U.S. and China are pledging to work together in addressing the threat posed by North Korea's nuclear program. During a news conference with his Chinese counterpart, Tillerson said regional tensions have reached a dangerous level. Tillerson has been calling on Beijing to step up its efforts to encourage North Korea to abandon its nuclear program.
The track that we are now on is to use a number of steps with ever greater number of actions ahead of us that involve sanctions, which the United Nations Security Council has already approved, including China, which voted for those sanctions, and that we are calling on all countries to now fully implement those sanctions.
On Friday, Tillerson said the policy of strategic patience with North Korea has ended and that military action against Pyongyang is an option on the table. French officials say a man with suspected connections to Islamic extremists was fatally shot at a Paris airport Saturday after attempting to steal the rifle of a patrol soldier. No one else was injured at the Paris airport. The Paris prosecutor's office said the suspect had his home searched in 2015 after the terror attack in Paris that killed 130 people because of his suspected connection to radical Islam. Authorities say the man is also suspected of shooting a police officer earlier Saturday during a traffic stop before stealing a car at gunpoint in a Paris suburb. Saturday's airport attack occurred as France remains under a state of emergency after attacks over the past 2 years that have killed 235 people. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. The Trump administration has appealed a decision by federal courts in the states of Maryland and Hawaii that struck down parts of the newest Trump travel ban, both ruling that it discriminated against Muslims. Mr. Trump reacted this way.
This ruling makes us look weak, which, by the way, we no longer are, believe me. Just look at our border.
President Trump's new travel ban, which was supposed to go into effect early Thursday, was reissued with the intention of overcoming any legal concerns with the first travel ban. Buses began transporting Syrian rebels and their families Saturday from the last opposition-held neighborhood in the central city of Homs. Their departure is part of a Russian-backed deal signed early this month. Officials say the exodus will take several weeks. Thousands of civilians are also expected to leave Homs rather than risk arrest by the Syrian security forces. A rocket launched from the Gaza Strip Saturday exploded near the Israeli city of Ashkelon, drawing a response from Israel. No one was injured by the rocket, which landed in an open area. Israel responded to the rocket attack by targeting two Hamas outposts with tank and aircraft fire. They also reported no casualties. Somalia officials say Malaysia is sending troops to the drought-stricken country as part of the humanitarian mission to avert famine and save the lives of thousands of people. The Malaysian defense minister said Saturday his country will send 3 officers, 17 personnel from the Armed Forces Medical Corps to Somalia, along with food and medical supplies. Somalia appealed for help early this week during a diplomatic meeting in Malaysia. Hillary Clinton, who lost the presidential election to Donald Trump last year, says she is, in her words, ready to come out of the woods and help Americans find common ground. During a speech Friday, Clinton urged a divided country to work together to solve problems, recalling how as First Lady, she met with female leaders working to bring peace to Northern Ireland. Aside from making speeches in the coming weeks, Clinton also is working on a book of personal essays that she says will include some reflections on her loss to Trump. Officials at the U.S. National Park Service says cold weather has destroyed half of Washington's beloved cherry blossoms. The display normally attracts more than 1 million tourists to the Capitol. A late winter storm brought snow freezing temperatures this week, just as the peak display of blossoms was about to begin. Japan donated the cherry trees to the U.S. in 1912 to honor the two countries' friendship. For details on more news, we invite you to join us at voanews.com. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The first reaction was of surprise, disbelief, and then horror, and now scare, because Kawisi obviously is a very well-known face among Ugandan society because he has been the spokesman of the Uganda Police Force.
An Assistant Inspector General of the Ugandan Police is assassinated.
Unless the international community come forward with resources and expertise that potentially may threaten the abilities of humanitarian organizations to deliver life-saving critical assistance to these refugees.
The UN aid agency appeals for funds to enable it to provide the needed assistance to thousands of South Sudanese refugees.
We see a lot of extravagance here when it comes to the king acquiring the jet.
And the Kingdom of Swaziland purchases a new jet for King Nswati III. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The spokesman for the Ugandan police was killed by unknown assailants in Kulambilo, a suburb of the capital Kampala, Friday. Andrew Felix Kawesi, who is also the Assistant General of Police, was shot and killed in his car along with two other officers as he left his home. The gunmen were reportedly on motorcycles known locally as Boda Boda. Meanwhile, President Yoweri Museveni has condemned the killings and has urged Ugandans to be vigilant. For reaction, I reached Tabubu Tajira, the acting managing editor for content at the Monitor publication, a major Ugandan independent newspaper.
The first reaction was of surprise, disbelief, and then horror, and now scare, because Kawisi obviously is a very well-known face among Ugandan society because he's been the spokesman of Uganda Police Force. And he, at the rank of Assistant Inspector General of Police, means he's in the third highest rank within Uganda Police Force. And I think what was first more surprising was the timing of the killing, because this happened at just about 9:30 in the morning. And then the assailants pumped just multiple bullets. That it could happen and happen during the daytime has left everybody puzzled with the question of, so who actually can be safe if the Assistant Inspector General of Police can be executed so brutally and in broad day?
Some people that I spoke with are saying that if the Assistant Inspector General of Police, who had got and a driver who is well regarded in the Ugandan society, could be killed with such impunity, then what is their fate?
Absolutely. I mean, that is the most puzzling question. But also, of course, that type of precise or clinical execution isn't new. Since 2012, according to police records, at least 12 people have been killed that way. So Kawesi is the 12th person. The manner of killing seems to be the same. The assailants come on a motorcycle. They shoot, deflate the tire, and they pump bullets. They go to confirm the person they have killed is dead, and they get back on the motorbike and they run away. And this happened with a number of Muslim leaders in the country. It also happened with the former senior state prosecutor called Joan Kagezi, who was prosecuting, you know, the suspects in the bombing attacks on Uganda. It's just unbelievable that there is a consistent pattern of how these executions are happening, and somehow the intelligence hasn't been able to track either the perpetrators or work ahead of them to prevent others.
I heard the president has issued a directive about CCTV or cameras to be installed and all that. Some people are saying his reaction was timid and his proposal might not necessarily be enough.
Obviously, I shared the same thought that the president's reaction was knee-jerk and it was inadequate to respond to the threat level. The issue with this group is that they're not amateurs. They are certainly well-trained or perhaps well-connected assassins who know that they have the protection of some kind. and their fear is not to be seen, because in this case, they shot the Assistant Inspector General of Police daytime. So whether or not the CCTV is not for them an issue, they don't worry about being seen. That's one. The second aspect is the confidence with which they act. And the side aspect is that even if you have to procure CCTV cameras, that's going to take a lot of time. And I'm sure the contracts for the award will run into contest and so on. And by the time you install it, it will probably be 2 years from now. But you need CCTV footage, and you need to link it up with the national data bank, that the images you capture on CCTV can be matched into an existing record, which enable into central record, which then can enable people to track the perpetrators. But if you install CCTVs in isolation of an existing data infrastructure with which it can be compared, what purpose will it exactly serve? Because you can capture a person's face, but if you don't know their address, if you can't link whether this face belongs to Tabu or belongs to Kloti, how and then does that help you fight crime? And the side aspect is that, of course, CCTV is a post-mortem approach. It's that the government will want to know how a crime happened and who likely suspects are. It doesn't support the prevention aspect. And therefore, because the principal role of a state or of a government is to protect the lives and property of its citizens, the investment must be in strengthening intelligence in order to crack into the criminal networks and then invest into prevention rather than, you know, crime curative approach of coming after the fact. That really doesn't solve the problem of preventing the crime from happening.
Tabu Butajira is the acting managing editor for Content at The Monitor, a major Ugandan independent newspaper. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch has called for an independent investigation into alleged killings by Ugandan military and police during joint operations in Kasese, Western Uganda, in November last year. In a report released this week, Maria Burnett, Associate Africa Director at Human Rights Watch, says scores of people, including children, were killed. Charles Mwanguye Mpaji is Uganda Bureau Chief for the East African newspaper. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached him in Kampala to find out about public reaction to the report.
One of the major things that people are talking about here is that what Maria Burnett has done and Human Rights Watch has done is brings to light in a collated way facts that people have known for a very long time since the attacks in November last year. So basically the broad question is there anything significantly new that she introduces in her report? The majority perception here is that there isn't much, save for the fact that she mentioned one fact that hasn't been talked about, which is the fact about children being killed in that attack. But as to the scale, the background to the attacks, and what has happened since, I think that's been pretty much common knowledge.
It's common knowledge that the palace must have had some children, right?
No, that's highly disputed. But the question is, if you listened or watched government spokespeople yesterday, especially the spokesperson for the army and the one for the Uganda police, the major question they're not able to answer is that no opportunity was provided for an armed civilian to exit. And the second question is, could the palace have been there with parents, with people who hung around the king, without children among them? But the question they've been raising is, give us the list of children, give us their names, give us their ages, and give us their parents who are saying that their children were killed in these attacks, in these clashes.
The government has reacted angrily to this report, calling for an independent, impartial fact-finding mission.
Definitely, yes. It's not surprising that they would react angrily and disagree with what happened. That it presented a horrible scene, as Maria Burnett says in her report, the worst scale since the Northern Uganda war more than a decade ago. What came out in November last year, what everybody watched, was truly horrifying. Now, the major discussion, the major debate here, or the major effort government has invested in, is to portray the victims or the people who were killed in that attack not as innocent hangers around the court of the king, but rather as an armed militia that was engaged in subversive activities against the state. The government spokespeople here have been trying to push that line on Twitter and other social media platforms, trying to push back against the Human Rights Watch report, saying what we're dealing with was a group of bandits, a group of terrorists that were committing treasonous acts.
It seems it's going to be tough for the government to ward off the calls for an independent investigation, as the U.S. government is backing the Human Rights Report's call to have an independent investigation. The European Union also issued a statement in support of the same thing. Do you think the pressure from the U.S. and EU may have an impact on government to reconsider?
I see Kampala getting angrier, at least outwardly, for the consumption of the public. But internally, it has to do a lot of reflection and reconsidering of its position. Because I have read the statement from the European Union ambassador in Kampala, and it's fairly strongly worded. And they're saying that if government says it does not lack capacity to do an investigation, then it should go ahead and do that investigation, which is essentially to back what Human Rights Watch demanded. I hadn't looked at the statement from the United States government, but I think if it speaks in the same language as the European Union, then definitely we can expect that a bit of pressure is being added to the government for it to reconsider how it's handling this whole matter.
Charles Mongui Mpaji is the Kampala Bureau Chief for the East African newspaper. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kampala. The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Uganda has appealed to the international community to help with financial efforts to provide assistance to South Sudanese refugees. The UNHCR says its funding appeal for Uganda is short by more than a quarter of $1 billion. The UN aid agency also says transit facilities established in northern Uganda, set up to deal with the newly arriving refugees from South Sudan, are becoming overwhelmed. To learn more about the refugee situation, I reach Charlie Yaxley, a spokesman for the UNHCR in the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Uganda continues to maintain open borders to these refugees. It's welcomed these refugees with open arms, and the humanitarian response is there, providing food, water, and a roof over people's heads. But we continue to operate in a situation of severe underfunding. Our own funding appeal for Uganda is short by more than $250 million. And unless the international community come forward with resources and expertise, that potentially may threaten the abilities of humanitarian organizations to deliver life-saving critical assistance to these refugees.
I understand the rapid influx of refugees in the transit facilities in northern Uganda set up to deal with the new arrivals from South Sudan are becoming overwhelmed. How is the UNHCR dealing with this, particularly when you have a deficit of $267 million to help provide much-needed aid to these refugees?
Well, we continue to receive significant numbers of new arrivals. In March, the average daily new arrival rate is at more than 2,800 people. This is placing the reception facilities under tremendous strain, and it does require collective action from the international community to support Uganda to give these refugees an environment in which they can live in safety and in dignity. And that support needs to come in two forms. First of all, it's key that the humanitarian appeal is fully funded. It will allow the humanitarian organizations the budgets to provide this critical aid to the refugees. But we also need those in the international community who have influence over the respective leadership in South Sudan to use that influence to address the root causes of why these people are being forced to flee. It's vital that the warring parties come together in dialogue to bring an urgent end to the bloodshed. And only that way can we prevent more people being forced to flee. And only that way can we create a situation where those who are already refugees are able to safely return home.
The government of South Sudan in the capital, Juba, says that the situation is safe for humanitarian agencies such as the UNHCR to provide aid to the people who are internally displaced. How is the UNHCR handling the situation in South Sudan as well?
Well, there are reports from the refugees, particularly the armed groups, are operating on the major roads. and preventing people from those that they come across from using these drugs. We hear reports of people being killed or extorted for money, sexual assaults against women. So really, we do urge all parties to the conflict to ensure that there is a safe humanitarian space for people fleeing the conflict to do so safely, to be able to exercise their fundamental human right to seek asylum, but also to ensure that humanitarian agencies are able to access these people to provide them with the food, water, and critical care that they require.
Since the UNHCR sent word about the shortfall of the amount of money needed for humanitarian assistance, what has been the response from the international donors or international community about this?
Well, we're very grateful for partners in the international community that have come forward with funding. But it remains the case that currently the South Sudan crisis is not receiving anywhere near the amount of attention and funding it needs. At present, funding for the South Sudan emergency across the region has received just 8% of the $781 million humanitarian agencies need to provide humanitarian assistance to these people affected by conflict who are fleeing through no fault of their own.
Charlie Yaxley is a spokesman for the UNHCR in Uganda. He spoke with me from Kampala. The Swazi government says it will purchase a new jet for King Eswatini III. This after the king says it gave $20 million to the foreign ministry to purchase the 375-seater Airbus China Airlines in Taiwan. Acting Foreign Affairs Minister Edgar Hillary says the plane is being refurbished to conform to standards, seen as being fit for His Royal Majesty the King. For reaction, I reach Infandlana Shongwe, Deputy General Secretary of Swaziland's banned political opposition group PUDEMU in the country's commercial capital, Manzini.
We see a lot of extravagance here when it comes to the king acquiring the jet. But what is most confusing is that already he has got a jet that is not used very often, the one that has been detained somewhere in Canada. And we also have a jet that was leased from South Africa. You know, our government has revived one defunct airways, which when it collapsed did not make money at all.
But Shongwe, the argument is that that is supposed to be the country's jet that will be used commercially. And this is a private jet they are talking about, an estimated $20 million given to the foreign ministry to purchase the jet from China Airlines in Taiwan.
What is surprising is that he arrived from India using that jet. We see nothing wrong with the present jet. So it is surprising everyone as to why would we buy the King jet. But the reason is simple. The reason is that our MPs basically are trying to look good in front of the King, because every time they want to buy a King something, they would go to him and say, we want to buy you a jet. And also find that the money that they put aside or they set aside for buying this jet is taken from the government coffers.
Some are suggesting that the plane is old and that is why they need a newer plane for the King's safety. Why do you disagree on that?
Remember that before this present jet that he used over the weekend, before it was handed over to him, it went for a refurbishment or it went for a mechanical checkup or whatever. So we cannot say that a jet is old because it is still licensed to fly. Why did they buy it in the first place? Remember, they first said it was a donation from somewhere, and later on when we learned that it had been attached by the Salkahoa guy, and then they later said, no, they had bought it. We do not want to believe that the present jet is old and they want to buy a new one. We do not want to believe that one.
Well, some Podemo members are saying that why wouldn't the government use the $20 million to increase public sector workers' pay instead of using it to buy this presidential jet? However, supporters of the government are saying that the king's security and safety is paramount, and that has to be attended to first, because no amount of money can be equated with the king's safety and security.
You see, during these times of our economic decline, one would expect a government to be very strict on spending. For instance, we are recovering from drought, and then we are recovering from rains. Our roads are devastated. Our roads are destroyed. And one would have thought that the priority in this case might not be the king's safety, but the priority might be the health issues, might be the roads. And moreover, if you look at the defense budget, it is so huge that one would be tempted to even believe that if they had taken some money from that budget, it would cover the king's jet at all. So there is absolutely no justification in buying the king's jet. Mind you, Swazis do not believe in the king flying. Recently, we've been told that while in India, he was riding Formula One car, and people are not happy about that.
Infantlana Shongwe is the Deputy General Secretary of Swaziland's banned political opposition group, Podemo. He spoke with me from Manzini. South Africa's government says it needs to update its immigration policy, a move that comes amid tensions of xenophobic attacks on African immigrants. Officials say their proposed policy starts from the premise that it is neither desirable nor possible to stop international migration. But among their proposals are changes that could make it more difficult for economic migrants to settle and for long-term residents to eventually get citizenship. VOA's Anita Power reports from Johannesburg.
The white paper released this week by Minister Malusi Gigaba proposes a number of changes in a nation long seen as a haven for migrants and asylum seekers from across Africa. Among them, the creation of processing centers for asylum seekers along South Africa's border, the end of an automatic path from long-term residency to citizenship, the introduction of a points-based system intended to attract highly skilled immigrants, and the elimination of some visa requirements for African citizens. Gigaba told journalists that this proposal, which will go before Parliament next week, aims to strike a delicate balance between welcoming millions of migrants from African countries and keeping the nation safe. The new policy comes amid a new wave of violence against African immigrants who violent protesters accuse of taking jobs and scarce resources away from South Africans.
South Africa is committed to freeing movement in a managed way. And we will be looking at what is happening in West Africa to draw lessons from how West Africa is dealing with this process and to the extent possible to begin implementing some of those measures, because most certainly the South African international migration policy must be Afrocentric.
Last year, the Department of Home Affairs said 16 million people arrived in South Africa. Most came from neighboring countries like Lesotho, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Swaziland, and Botswana. The government also documented the arrival of more than 400,000 Americans and upwards of 560,000 British nationals. That same year, immigration officials deported more than 23,000 people, most of them from Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Lesotho, Swaziland, and Malawi. Tony Elumelu, director of the Commission on Free Movement of Persons for the Economic Community of West African States, says South Africa's proposed policy works well with the transitory nature of intra-African migration.
We are highly mobile people, but we do not stay. So if we do not stay permanently, all we do is allow us to go and come back.
Human rights activists have expressed concern, though, over the proposal. Jacob van Harderen, National Director of Lawyers for Human Rights, says the proposals on asylum seekers are worrying.
We are concerned that some of the laudable mission statements in the white paper is not or are not translated into reality through the sections that follow. So we're very concerned about additional restrictions that are being introduced or proposed for asylum seekers, the creation of additional detention centres in the various provinces, the removal of the right to work and study for asylum seekers. There also seemed to be a further push for the criminalisation of immigration offences, which is deeply unfortunate.
Gigaba will deliver the paper to South Africa's cabinet next week and says he is hopeful that the proposals will be passed by Parliament. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Right now, it's time for music from African collection.
Once upon a rhyme,
nakumbuka Mary alikusumbua.
Once upon a time, once upon a rhyme,
ujitahidi sana bado kachengua.
Umekumbwa na jini gani? Mbona mami hatuelewani? Hata jini kisirani so kama we,
wala jini makata kufikiwe.
Kosa langu kukuweka ndani, haijulikani ndani mwanaume nani. Kila siku vituko tu,
mara moja moja baby unajiweka down.
Kwanza sema na moyo wako, usiringie uzuri wako. Kuna kupandaga mami na kushuka,
tupendane forever mpaka kufa.
Usiku nikipita Twitter, mami na kukuta Twitter. Nikisema nikucheki Insta, nakuta usha posti picha.
Pesa zisikupe uchizi, kiburi na kutudharau.
Wale tulokupa shavu, sasa unatusahau.
Punguza maringo kidogo ya, punguza na nyodo kidogo ya, wacha kubinua kichugu,
hata wende wapi kwako nimesha nasa.
Go down, hata mara moja moja go down,
tembele.
Go down, hata mara moja moja jiweke down. Go down, hata mara moja moja go down,
tembele.
Go down, hata mara moja moja jiweke down.
Tulia,
baby girl,
mami,
mosha, please.
It's Jikoni, baby.
Everybody come.
you follow me go. Make you follow me, they feel the rhythm. Say you know I'm capable of. I am capable in every season. Make you dance and feel the flow. Make you drink and party with me. When the body don't start to play, say you know I'm the melody key.
And anything you need, I got ya. And don't do be. You got, I got the answer.
What you're feeling inside you, you got to let me know. Say what I'm feeling inside me, I got to let it show. And you know, Odoviapa, I know they see nothing. And you know, when they see apa, I know they see person. I want you to dance, go. Yeah, I want you to dance, go. Yeah, I want you to move slow, low, low.
We want to run down. Now when the sun is done, gone down. But this place nothing like gone down. The intention not to paint the town brown. Salad glass, the hobby one chill. Anybody gon' come for here, they know the drill. Hey, oh yeah, make it chill. For real.
I'm not a jolly, nah, it matter.
And don't do be, oh yeah, ma.
So baby, scare, baby, come closer.
I don't bite, cause any question you got, I got the answer.
What you're feeling inside you, you got to let me know. Say what I'm feeling inside me, I got to let it show. And you know, Odoviapa, I know they see nothing. And you know, when I see apa, I know they see person.
Hey,
I want you to dance, go. Yeah, hey, I want you to dance, go. Yeah, I want you to move slow, low, low.
Asking for more, you don't need any reason. Just follow the beating. This here ain't no prison, so follow my leading.
Inside you, you got to let me know. Say what I'm feeling inside me, I got to let it show. And you know, Odoviapa, I know they see nothing. And you know, when they see apa, I know they see person.
Oh, I'm making a dance, go.
Oh,
me throw away. Maybe you could fashion me go today. Maybe you could carry me throw away. Maybe you could fashion me go tomorrow. Maybe you could carry me throw away. Maybe you could fashion me marry tomorrow. Maybe you could take me marry tomorrow.
Bajo, bajo, my, you got 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 my way. All I do his way. Oh, only do his way. I try to spread love, but I know a lot of people still don't get me. I
don't know why.
I can't say I don't wanna know, but if you gon' take it to your grave, hurry up and die. Protected by an invisible cloth, and God is my only tailor. You're only gonna go against him if you wish him me nothing but failure. All I do is win. All I do is win.
All I do is win, win, win.
All I do is win.
All I do is win, win, win.
All I do is win.
All I do is win, win, win.
They say every man for himself, but I choose to watch your back. A soldier at heart, so we are the same whether white or black. Clean out your hearts, I'm reaching out to you, all my African people. If love is your weapon, I promise you that you will fear no evil. All I do is win.
All I do is win, win, win.
All I do is win.
All I do is win, win, win.
All I do is win. All I do is win. Fight with all of my might just to reach the top. I wanna take a breather, but my enemies ain't gonna stop. So why should I? Here's my reply. When they ask me about all of my achievements, I say, hold your head high, pray to the sky. Cause when you believe it, that's when you win.
All I do is win, win.
All I do is win.
All I do is win, win, win.
All I do is win.
All I do is win, win, win.
All I do is win. Sing, I'm a hustler, I can make one turn two. No, you don't have a curse, hear the words in the verse and just know your word. Put yourself first, even if you drink, keep up the touch till they put you in the dirt and win.
All I do is win, win, win.
All I do is win.
Goza, 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 yeah. I do this for my
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impunga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaites, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if you search for the laws of harmony, you will find knowledge. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In Somalia, the civilian population continues to suffer the consequences of Somalia's long-running conflict, despite the fact that the government of Somalia has made strides towards improving governance. The U.S. State Department's 2016 Human Rights Report on Somalia underscores the need for the government of Somalia to do more to ensure that its citizens live a dignified life. Federal and regional security forces, often acting independently, continue to arbitrarily detain and recruit children. Large-scale forced evictions of internally displaced persons, including by government forces, continued in 2016. The government of Somalia must focus on human rights training of its security forces, respect for internally displaced persons, and accountability for those government officials who abuse their power. The worst violations of human rights were committed by the Al-Shabaab terrorist group. The group perpetrated targeted killings, beheadings, and executions. Within the territory it controls, it administered arbitrary justice, forcibly recruited children, and severely restricted basic rights. In 2016, Al-Shabaab targeted civilians and civilian structures, resulting in numerous casualties. Al-Shabaab has conducted attacks on employees of non-governmental organizations, the United Nations, and diplomatic missions. It also blocked humanitarian assistance, conscripted child soldiers, and restricted freedoms of speech, press, assembly, and movement. Al-Shabaab has banned independent media from reporting in areas under its control and threatens and targets journalists in government-controlled areas. There were also reports that AMISOM troops committed sexual abuse and exploitation, including rape of women and girls. As Secretary of State Rex Tillerson wrote in the introduction to this year's Human Rights Report, standing up for human rights and democracy is not just a moral imperative, but is in the best interests of the United States in making the world more stable and secure. The 2016 Human Rights Reports demonstrate the United States' unwavering commitment to advancing liberty, human dignity, and global prosperity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.